Everyone called it the storm cellar. In this small compartment at the rear of the habitat module, the bulky propellant tanks attached to the spacecraft's outer hull provided a measure of protection against the lethal radiation spawned from a solar flare. The two Mars-bound craft used their half-depleted propellant tanks to absorb some of the high-energy particles streaming out from the sun. In addition, the craft's storm cellars were lined with thin filaments of superconducting wire. The first person to reach the radiation shelter, Pete Connors, as it turned out, punched the switch on the wall by the hatch to energize the shielding system. The superconducting wire generated a strong magnetic field around the storm cellar, strong enough to deflect the lightweight electrons in the cloud of particles swarming past the spacecraft. But the heavier protons were the real danger, and the magnetic field was not nearly strong enough to deflect them. Instead, the ship's defenses included a set of electron guns that charged the outer skin of the spacecraft to millions of volts of positive charge. In theory, the incoming protons would be deflected from the spacecraft by its megavolt positive charge, while the craft's magnetic field would keep electrons from reaching the skin and neutralizing the positive charge. Small versions of the system had been tested aboard satellites flung into sun-centered orbits. Unmanned satellites. "How long will we have to stay in here?" asked Ilona Maliter. She was sitting between Tony Reed and the Greek biologist on the backup team, Dennis Xenophanes. Her long fingers clutched the edge of the bench so tightly her knuckles were white.
12 hours or more," answered Ollie Zeman, the American astronaut who was Connor's backup. "Maybe a couple of days."
"My God."
"No sweat," Zeman replied, almost jovially. "Radiation level in here is almost normal."
The shelter already felt crowded and sweltering with the smell of suppressed fear. Jamie leaned his back against the bulkhead, wondering if the magnetic field being generated by the superconducting wires mere inches away from his flesh actually had no effect on their bodies. According to the system's designers, the field was shaped so that the storm cellar was in the clear. The field extended outward in all directions, but the shelter itself was like a bubble in its middle. Vosnesensky and his backup, Dmitry Ivchenko, were standing in front of the communications console built into the shelter's forward bulkhead by the hatch. Mikhail had clamped a communications headset over his curly hair.
"Radio communication is difficult," Vosnesensky announced loudly for everyone to hear, even though he kept his back to them. "We will use the laser system."
A magnetic storm can screw up radio waves, Jamie knew, but it shouldn't have any effect on a laser's beam of light. He felt a tightness in his chest, anxiety, even though they had trained for such emergencies. There's a semi-infinite number of subatomic particles out there just dying to get in here and kill all 12 of us, he thought, like a cloud of spirits of the dead scratching and moaning outside the door.
"Mars 2 is all right," Vosnesensky announced. "Everyone in the storm cellar with no trouble."
"They've got the extra man," Jamie thought. "Dr. Lee makes it 13 they have to squeeze into their shelter." Pete Connors got up and went to stand between Vosnesensky and the other Russian.
"All the ship systems are working okay?" he asked loudly. "Yes, yes."
Vosnesensky pointed to the panels of lights that showed the condition of the rest of the ship. Most of the lights were green.
"The equipment was built to withstand radiation. It is only we fragile creatures of flesh and bone who need protection."
Cheerful, Jamie thought. Very cheerful. 14 hours later, the radiation levels outside the shelter had not gone down discernibly. Jamie had dozed for a while, slumped back on a bench that lined the compartment's wall. Joanna and the Polish biochemist who was Ilona's backup had found enough room on the opposite bench to curl up and sleep. There were fold-out cots built into the walls above the benches, but no one had bothered to use them. Looking around with blurry eyes, Jamie saw that all four pilots were sitting up near the hatch and the comm console. The Christmas tree of monitoring panels still showed mostly green lights, although there were more red ones than before. Tony Reed was chatting amiably with Ilona and the Aussie geologist George O'Hara at the other end of the compartment, where food and drink dispensers were built into the rear wall. Jamie pulled himself to his feet, feeling stiff and dull-headed. O'Hara was red-haired, raw-boned, tall enough to need to stoop slightly unless he stood exactly in the midline of the compartment. Otherwise, his head brushed the curving ceiling panels.
He seemed an amiable enough sort. Jamie had not detected a trace of jealousy over the fact that O'Hara was to stay aboard the ship while he would be the one to go down to the surface.
"In Cuba, Petty, the miners live underground most of the year," O'Hara was saying. "Too bloody hot to live up on the surface, so they've built a goddamn city down in the shafts and galleries, swimming pools and everything."
Ilona was not impressed. "How much longer must we stay in here?"
"Don't be so anxious to go out," Tony said.
"This is the best place in the entire solar system to be right now."
"Except for Earth," said Jamie.
"Ah, well," Reed admitted. "We can't have everything now, can we?"
"Reminds me of being stuck inside a bloody airliner," O'Hara said, grinning down at Ilona. "I remember once, a couple years ago at Washington National, they had us buttoned up on the rampway and made us wait 5 bloody hours inside the bloody airplane before we could take off. Some mechanical problem they took their sweet time fixing. We drank all the booze on board and we still hadn't moved a fucking inch. It was like a zoo by the time we actually took off."
"I'm feeling as if I'm in a zoo," Ilona muttered, "in a cage."
"Steady on," Tony said in his best British stiff upper lip manner, but he looked tight to Jamie, tense, his smile forced.
"How much longer will it be?" Joanna's sleepy voice came from behind Jamie. It was a rhetorical question. She pushed past them and went into the lavatory.
"Ever wonder why they always put the pisser next to the water fountain?"
O'Hara asked no one in particular.
"Plumbing," Jamie said.
"Or recycling," suggested Reed. Jamie walked the length of the compartment, as much to stretch his legs and get some circulation going as to reach the pilots up by the comm console and equipment monitors. Katrin Diels, the German physicist, was deep in earnest conversation, a headset clamped over her blonde curls.
"When did the intensity peak?" she asked into the pin-sized microphone in front of her lips. Jamie almost smiled at the fierce intensity on her snub-nosed, freckled face. She was slight of frame, as butter-blonde and blue-eyed as the people you would see in a travel poster advertising Oktoberfest. The pilots had made room for her, and she sat on the end of the bench where she could operate the communications console. She whipped the headset off and sprang to her feet.
"Good news, everybody!" she called out. "The Lunar Observatory reports that the storm's intensity peaked almost an hour ago."
Smiles broke out, heads nodded, everyone murmured happily.
"According to the orbiting magnetosphere observatories," Diels continued, "the storm should be over in another 12 to 16 hours.
Groans. "Another 16 hours in here?" Tony Reed raised his arms for silence.
"Now don't complain. As long as the toilet works, we should be perfectly fine."
Ilona was not amused.
16 more hours. Ugh.
"Try to relax," Reed urged.
"Take a nap."
"Would you like to play a game of bridge?" asked the Greek biologist.
"Not with you," O'Hara snapped. "It's like swimming with a bloody shark."
Xenophanes laughed, but to Jamie it seemed strained. Vosnesensky said,
"We should not sit idly for another 14 hours.
Ilona's lips curled into the start of a sneering reply, but before she could say anything, Reed jumped in.
"What would you suggest, Mikhail Andreevich?"
the Englishman asked.
"A workers' council," the Russian replied. "We are all here. None of us has pressing duties to perform. Now is the time for a self-analysis session."
"A quality circle like the Japanese?"
asked Tad Schlewa, the backup biochemist.
"More like a self-criticism circle," said Ilona, "like prisoners in Siberia."
Vosnesensky's beefy face flushed slightly, but he did not reply to her. Ivchenko, lean in face and body, darkly handsome in an almost Levantine way, said,
"Self-analysis can be a very useful way to examine interpersonal problems."
There was some argument, but Vosnesensky was determined, and none of the others really had any suggestions to offer as an alternative. So the 12 men and women sat along the benches facing one another.
"How do we start?" asked Ali Zeman.
"I will start," Vosnesensky said. "This was my idea, so I will be the first volunteer."
"You're right ahead," said Reed, sitting across the central aisle from the Russian. Vosnesensky glanced at Ilona, then turned his gaze to sweep the men and women on the bench opposite him.
"I feel resentment from some of you. Resentment that I am in command. Resentment, perhaps, that a Russian is in command."
"That's rather natural, is it not?" asked Katrin Diels. "There's bound to be..."